95.7 Ben FM presents Her Story with Kathy Romano.
Welcome to Her Story. I'm Kathy Romano. Thanks so much for joining me again this morning. Back in April, we had our second annual Her Story Networking Luncheon. It was held at the Arts Ballroom, a beautiful venue right in Philadelphia. We had a number of great speakers tell us a little about their story during the event. And our special guest of the day was Rachel Ray. I had the opportunity to sit down with Rachel and delve into her life a bit. So today, I'd like to play back my Her Story interview with Rachel Ray right here on 95.7 Ben FM. Enjoy. You can catch The Rachel Ray Show weekdays at 10 a.m. on 6ABC. Please welcome Rachel Ray.
Hey, gang. Hello. And a day drinker. They literally told me I could bring a cocktail to the stage. So I thought that that meant they wanted me to lighten up a little. You look amazing, by the way, in the pink hat. I was watching you from the balcony.
She's known as the hat lady.
She's amazing.
She is. She wears hats like that to every event that she
because
goes out at.
Because she can, and she does.
If you haven't heard already, with the Her Story Show, I delve into people's lives, into women's lives. So I want to start with you and where you grew up. You're from the Adirondacks. You grew up in Glen Falls, and you lived in Lake George.
Actually, I was born in Glens Falls, but I went to school in Cape Cod. I went to Mashpee Central School when I was very little. We moved to Massachusetts after my birth. And from, I don't know, about second grade on, I lived in upstate New York. But yes, I'm an upstate New Yorker, basically.
Your grandfather lived in the home with you. How did that impact
your life?
When
I was very young, he was my babysitter. My mother doesn't trust people. She's Sicilian. And and she works in the restaurant business. Two great reasons not to trust people, right? So, you know, for my mom, we would be with her on her hip in the restaurant, or we would be at home with grandpa. And when I was little, my grandpa was my caretaker and my best friend. And, you know, like some people, you watch actors and actresses say they were born with an old soul. I don't think I was born with an old soul. One was forced upon me. I only lived with 70-something Sicilian men all day and night as a baby and a toddler. The Runzo boys and my grandpa were my best friends, so I liked sardine sandwiches with onions, the smell of pipes and hand-rolled cigarettes and homemade wine. My first word was vino because my grandpa got sick of chasing my baba. I was on formula. My mother's very tiny, and she's a worker. So, you know, long story short, I was on formula, not a breastfed baby. That's what happened. And Grandpa would put his wine in my baba because I would keep throwing the formula across the room. I didn't like it. So he'd hold up my bottle and he'd go, vino, vino. So the first picture of me at the table, I'm in one of those hook-on high chairs, and my hand's way in the air like this, and it says Rachel's first word, vino. I was just asking for my baba, but it always had wine and water in it, so people got the idea that I was a good baby, but really I was just a little drunk. Red cheeks. Good quiet baby.
Yeah. So when did you learn to cook? Who taught you?
No one teaches you to cook in an Italian family, and a lot of other cultures too, but no one teaches you to cook. You're just told to do something, and you figure it out. Peel the potatoes, put it in the water. And everyone's always in the kitchen. The living room's only for strangers or, you know, whatever, after dinner. There is no process of learning how to cook. And, you know, I mean, my mother's one of 10 children. My grandfather's one of 14. My mother works in restaurants. We are people of service. We only live in the kitchen. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. People ask me that for, you know, I'm almost 50, and people ask me that my whole life, and I'm like, no one. Why do people have to teach you to cook in your house? Like, it's just one of those things you learn to live, you know? You have to learn how to make a scrambled egg and a steak and cook some pasta and whatever. All the men and women can at least make supper in the way we were raised, and literally no one ever said, here's how you do this thing. It was just, you were around it, and that's where everyone was, and someone would say, peel the potatoes, and you'd figure it out. And I like that. It teaches you self-sufficiency. And I mean, they didn't let, well, that's not true. I was going to say they didn't let small children play near the stove, but that's not true. My first memory. I was on my mother's hip in the restaurant that she was running, and phones used to have cords, and the kitchen phone in the restaurant had a very long one, and she had gotten so worked up. We're very animated people, and she had gotten so worked up she had walked in circles with me on her hip, so we were tied up in the cord. So she spun the counterclockwise to unwrap it, and when she went to hang up the phone, I was trying to mimic her, and there was a big flat top, a hot top griddle, and I reached up for one of the giant spatulas was sitting on the edge of the line in front of the pickup window, and I reached up for the spatula because I'd seen it in her hand so many times, and I tried to grab it, and she had just turned all of the grills on. I grilled my thumb to the flat top.
Oh, my God.
Whatever, get over it.
It's okay.
I'm Harry Potter. I was marked for the kitchen.
Oh, my God. All right, so what was your first job in the restaurant industry?
Going to work with my mother. We were all worked in the kitchens before we were allowed to have working papers. But once I got working papers, I had the hardest job I think there is. DMO, dish machine operator. That was my first job.
And did you ever work as a waitress, a bartender?
Everything, of course. I grew up in restaurants.
You did, yeah. So when was the first time then that you said, I can do this on TV?
I never wanted to be on television, not ever. I wanted to work in food, and I worked at Macy's, and I had a great job in New York City, and I loved it, and I ran marketplaces. And then my boss helped me get another job at a big, beautiful market called Agatha and Valentina, and I went to work for That Man. Then I got mugged twice at gunpoint, and I thought maybe New York's not for me, and I'm very superstitious. And I thought, if you get mugged twice, that means the third time you're going to die, so move back to the country, dummy. So I went back to the country, and I started over, and I had a little pickup truck, and eventually I got a job at a market in Albany, being their buyer. And we couldn't sell the groceries, and I polled my customers, you only buy prepared food, why don't you buy all this lovely stuff? And they said, because we don't know how to cook. So my boss and I, my friend Donna, known each other, oh my God, 25, maybe more years. Donna and I said, well, why don't you teach cooking classes? They'll people come. I said, Donna, I'm not a proper chef. They love your food. They bite out of the case. Go ahead. All right, whatever. Actually, our first idea was to get all the local chefs to do it, but Donna wanted to sell the gift certificates first, so she didn't sell them for enough money to hire the famous chefs. So then she said, we don't have enough money to pay them and keep the money we want to keep, so you teach it. So I did, and it became this happening, and then it was on the news, and then Food Network called, and I don't know, yada yada.
And you went from there.
No, that was an accident. Being on TV is an accident. I hate me on TV. I can't stand the sound of my voice. My dog gets freaked out. She looks for me behind the TV. I never watch me. I mean, I love doing it. It's wonderful to talk and have the opportunity to meet people from everywhere. But, I mean, that was a circumstance of life. You know, I think life is a combination of working harder than other people and not complaining about it. Then you'll get opportunity. That's what it is to be an American. What you do with that opportunity is up to you. You could continue to work harder than everybody else, or you can stay stagnant. I'm a person who likes to move forward. And then things present themselves. And then you have to close your eyes and say, can I do that or can I not do that? If you could picture yourself doing it. And as my mother said, if you're never embarrassed of where you come from, you can't be embarrassed of where you might go. Because the worst thing that can happen to you is you go back to who you are.
You said you hate watching yourself on TV. I don't think anybody in this room hates that. We all love it. So, you favor quick and easy cooking.
She has such a body. I told her, that dress is amazing. I said, if I had that body, I would literally walk around naked to somebody in a restaurant. Unbelievable. And right? I hugged it up. It's all real. Whatever. It's a woman's thing.
We're all women here. It's okay.
I'm just complimenting you. In lovely ways. You're gorgeous.
So I want to talk about the 30-minute meals. You obviously favor it quick and easy. I am not a big cook, so I would imagine that when you came up
with
that
idea... That's who I work for. I work for people who hate to cook. 30-minute meals really just started because I thought it was silly that people would wait half an hour for the, like, not a great pizza. I won't say the worst. I don't know. I've never even had it at the time. But I'm like, you'll wait 30 minutes for a pizza promise. There used to be this promise from one of the big companies. And they said if they couldn't get there in 30 minutes, they give you your money back. So I thought, people don't know that they could make dinner in that same amount of time, because I polled them. And they said, you know, we went from post-World War II, where all the women were at work, in the factories and all of the jobs because all of the men were at war, and then they came home and we made the greatest generation. And then things just went, not bad, they went great, but the country became super prosperous, and then everybody went to work, and the women's movement and all that, and that's awesome. But then everybody got to be working around the clock, all the men and all the women got to be working around the clock so much we forgot about the things that we liked that we brought from all the places that we all come from, where everybody, rich or poor, knew how to take care of themselves. Everybody knew how to sew on a button and make a steak and make an egg, and you know, they spoke to each other and ate together and worked hard but never complained about it. Like all of the things that our relatives and grandparents and all of our forerunners here that fought so hard to be in a place where you're not going to be persecuted threw away kind of a little bit too much, I think. It went too far the other direction. Now we're going to be progressive and we're going to do everything and be everything and be young, have fun, drink Pepsi and make money and, you know, get it. We just sped up so much. I think we sped past a lot of things that were worth keeping. I think that's one of the benefits of my life, not being on TV, but growing up in a house where I had a first-generation American be a huge influence on my young life, so that I knew the value of time with each other and staying connected to the generations that came before you, and the value of work, and a mother that would make you work before you could even have a working paper. The mother, not the father. You know, when my mom graduated high school, she had wonderful grades, and she was told by her guidance counselor, not by her mother or other women in her community, by her male guidance counselor, that she could be a secretary or a wife. My mother worked in restaurants for 60 years and took a company from having 3 restaurants to having $1 billion a year in many restaurants. She kicked ass, and she started as a waitress, and everybody told her she should just be this one thing or this other thing. I love that about my mother. It was because we had a grandfather in the home who said, if you can close your eyes and you can see yourself doing it, why don't you do it? And a grandfather said to me when I came home, after my first day at school, I was the least popular girl. I had to wear a dress. Everybody else was in dungarees. You call them jeans. And I was not cool at all because I was in a dress, and my grandpa made me wear good shoes. And I brought a book, and my teacher took it away because the other kids didn't know how to read yet. And I got very dramatic about, what do you mean they don't know how to read? How can you take my book? And I went home saying they don't know how to eat, and lunch was terrible, and they took my book, and they made fun of me because I'm in a dress. My grandfather put a cold cloth on my face, put me in my PJs with little people on them. They were my favorite PJs. And he put me on my bed, and I thought he was being very sweet and sympathetic. And then he lectured me and tickled me till I was crying and choking all at the same time. And he wasn't spanking me. He just kept tickling me and tickling me. I said, stop, stop. And I'm pouring tears, and I'm all distraught and purple and pink and all weird colors. And he said, okay, I'll stop. And the point of it was, he made me count my fingers and my toes, and he knocked his hand on my head. And he said, if you can count 10 fingers and 10 toes and you have a brain in your head, what are you crying about? That's the people that I grew up with. There is no such thing as feeling sorry for yourself unless you have a very good reason to feel sorry for yourself. And there is no such thing as you're a man or a woman. You should always have respect for women. You should always have respect for men. You should always have respect for work itself. You should always have respect for your home. For the amount of money we had, every place we went in life and every meal we had was beautiful. It didn't matter if we were rich or poor. And to hear my mother talk, literally to hear my mother talk, again, she was the firstborn of 10. He was one of 14. The 4 youngest came here. To hear my mother talk about her childhood, you'd think they were gajillionaires or, you know, some member of aristocracy. He was a stonemason. They had no money, and yet their lives were so saturated and rich. And I just get a shadow of that. When other people daydream about being more famous than they are, I daydream about being who my mother was when she was a girl, because that's the life I wish I had lived. I love my life now. I love my husband, my dog, my mother. Thank you, God, is still with me and could kick my ass. She's 84. But I love the idea of the world she grew up in and how much she did without anybody telling her. There wasn't shows like yours or positive programming or women with movements and pins and things. My mother just did that instinctually. She's 84 years old. She was told to be a secretary or housewife. Mm-hmm. She did all that because it was just in her. She used to run restaurants, and if she had to speak to someone, she'd stand up on a milk crate so she could look them in the eye. My mother's only 4'10". She didn't like the idea that she was too short to speak to them in the eye because they weren't going to get her intensity, you know? There's so much about her I love. I can't. It's longer than I'm programmed for. So.
Well, I love that essentially she told you don't have to have money to be rich. You can have a rich life.
And it never came into it that I was a woman or a man or anything else. Yeah. It was about how hard do you want to work, period. And how much can you respect other human beings? Like, that's a big deal for
my mom.
I can remember the first time my mother, like, literally smacked me upside the head. I must have made a face as a small child or something, seeing someone that was different than me in the world. And I don't even remember what it was. Maybe it was someone who happened to be in a wheelchair or somebody who was taking too much time walking or something. I was being, you know, I'm in a rush or I'm dragging her or something. She literally pulled me back and boxed my ear and said, "You be mindful of your face. You're in public." I remember that. And it took one time. You be mindful. I'm tearing up because it's such a big lesson to learn. Be mindful of each other. And I tell people all the time, you know, all the work we do. Thank you, by the way, for your raffle today is benefiting our children's project. And we educate kids and we feed hungry kids. But I tell people all the time, the reason everything we do has orange behind it is it's the color of hunger awareness. I beg people to take children and their whole families out and go seek. I don't care what state you live in, what level you live at. Go see the people that are hungry in your community. They're your friends and neighbors. Some of them are rocket scientists. Some of them are doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. Some of them just got lost. But the face of hunger is all of ours in the richest country in the world. And we should be desperately ashamed of that color. People think I love orange, like I want to wear it all the time. And they send me scarves and shirts. And I'm like, no, it's actually a very sad color. That means we're letting our neighbors suffer. It's the opposite. But thank you for the scarves anyway.
Thank you for the orange. The Oxford American College Dictionary added EVOO, extra virgin olive oil. She made the dictionary.
I'm not a rocket scientist, but they only add a couple words. That started because at Food Network, I used to say extra virgin olive oil because what you can buy is extra virgin olive oil in an American grocery store isn't extra virgin olive oil at all. It's just olive oil, basically. The fancy green stuff you have to pay a lot more for. But I wanted people to cook with olive oil and stop using so much butter and homogenized fats and margarine and all that. And we only grew up with olive oil in our house. So I just got sick of saying it over and over, so I just said EVOO, and I don't know, stuck after a while.
And now it's in the dictionary.
And now it's in the dictionary. There's even some with my head on the bottle, at the best price, for real Italian.
Your love of coffee is well known, but you say you can't make a cup of coffee?
Yes. I make horrible coffee. It looks like urine or mud.
Okay.
I think my husband sabotages every coffee maker since the day I've met him, because I used to be able to make a cup of coffee. I just can't since I've met John. And every time he leaves town, something horrible happens. Yes, I'm infamous for that and setting bread on fire. I cannot make toast and I can't make coffee, so don't come over for breakfast. But since I don't sleep with any of you,
perfect.
I wasn't planning on you coming.
Speaking of your husband, he's a musician.
He is a musician, of course. He plays literally every instrument. He started on the piano. He plays every stringed instrument there is. He's a wonderful percussionist. He plays all types of keyboard instruments. And he's okay at the trumpet. John got into Berklee School of Music. He also got into law school. His parents, being Italian-Americans, wanted him to go the safe route and have a proper profession. And they said, we'll pay for school if you go to school to become a lawyer. John wanted to go to Berklee and should have gone to Berklee. John was born to be a musician. John wussed out and chose not to pay for himself to go to school, but to take mom and dad's advice, and so he became a lawyer. That saved me a bunch of money, but it's made him slightly fidgety man in life because he feels like a frustrated musician. He has a rock band named The Cringe, and eventually his live stream came true too. A couple summers ago, he became the opening band for the entire North American tour of Motley Crue and Alice Cooper.
Yep.
So his parents got their way, and they were right, and it saved me a bunch because he became an entertainment lawyer, so, and he runs our company. That's his day job. But he eventually, he kept at his music, too, and he's recording another album right now, actually.
So if you guys are at home and you need something quick to eat, you go to the cupboard, what are you making?
Well, I plan our meals obsessively days and weeks before. But there's always something to make. If I'm sick, John makes me minest. He makes me beans and greens, white beans and escarole. And John's a wonderful cook. You know, all cooks and chefs like to make the people that they're serving happy. We just want to make whatever you want to eat. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And cooks and chefs, we're not picky eaters at all. We'll literally eat anything. And we feed ourselves late at night after everybody else is gone. The last state dinner I went to at the White House, Mario Batali was cooking, and he made this fabulous, insane meal for the Obamas. And I sat at the head table next to the First Lady. And after my husband and I are wandering around the streets, I'm holding my shoes in my hand because my feet are so in pain. And we're walking up the street looking for the car, and there's the whole kitchen staff, and they're walking into the bar across the way. And they're all in there, all the chefs and cooks, and they're eating buffalo chicken sandwiches. Like, we all go home and make scrambled eggs with a little hot sauce. And my husband's favorite is a carbonara, and he doesn't like to eat before a show. So anytime John's playing a concert, we have midnight carbonara. Otherwise, I go home and I make dinner after work. I go home, I wash my face, I put on my funny slippers, and I go into the kitchen, I have a glass of wine. I've never cooked a 30-minute meal after a glass of wine in my life. And and I make dinner, you know? We like that, and my mother liked that, and my grandpa liked that. We never had a bedtime. If you were doing something creative, or if the family was eating together, you could be awake any hour of the night or day, period. There was no question about that. There was no set time to living and being creative. If you wanted to just not go to bed because you wanted to watch a TV show or something, no, you have to go to bed. But if you want to draw or read or paint or be with your family, there was no rule to that.
I absolutely love that.
I love it too. Obviously, but I'm biased.
When did you first meet Oprah?
After I was on Food Network, 4 or 5 years, I got a call to do the Oprah show, and I was on book tour, which is like 20 cities in 22 days. And they canceled my flight on my way into Chicago. And I was so upset. I just sat there on standby, running from airline to airline, pouring tears and swelling up my eyes like a buggy-eyed fish, or, you know, it just looked like golf balls. I cried all night long. I got to my hotel 45 minutes before I was supposed to get picked up for the Oprah show. I went in and ironed this hugely ridiculous skirt. I put on pantyhose and funny shoes and a sweater, and I ironed my skirt. My face was all swollen. I hadn't slept all night. I get to the Oprah show, the look of disappointment on the faces of the people that greeted me and the hair and makeup team.
Oh my God.
Was, I could literally read the thought bubbles over their head of, oh my God. And then they put powder on me and tried to help me and cool gloss on my face. And then they curled my hair into these giant ringlets and they tried to make me look like Oprah. So then I walk out onto Oprah for my first time, and I'm wearing this giant skirt and hose and heels, and my hair is curled in ringlets, and Oprah's wearing jeans and a cool Henley shirt. And she's all like windblown, and I'm like, it looks like she's trying to be me on 30-minute meals, and I'm trying to dress up like her. It was a nightmare. I was sweating so hard, and I was so nervous and overtired, and I hadn't slept all night. And we got to the first commercial break, and I said, I'm so sorry, I almost didn't make it, or blah, blah. And she just took my arm and she leaned in and she said, calm down, you've got it. Wow. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but that's good. and then a couple years later, my boss, or maybe a year later, I don't know, some days later, my boss, Brooke Johnson, who's a mentor and one of my dearest friends now at Food Network, she said, you should have a syndicated show. And I said, well, I can't have a syndicated show. I don't want to lose my show. I have cable shows, and cable hates syndicated. And she said, let me go talk to my people, but let's take you out in the world. And then Oprah wanted to be a part of that, and I ended up going on her show like 10 or 12 times or something. And she's the most gracious, lovely, and makes a hell of a pomegranate martini, and just a lovely, delightful. You know, the trippiest day of the last 20 years of my life was when we hit our 2000th show on the daytime show. It's about 20 years at Food Network, maybe 19. But we just passed in this season our 2000th episode on the daytime show. Oprah came and hosted it, and the whole show, I didn't know anything other than Oprah was coming. And I just thought, oh, my God, Oprah's introducing me? What? And the weirdest thing happened that day, no joke, true story. Every time she comes to our show or I know I'm going to see her, I make her a basket of, you know, they do Oprah's favorite things. Oprah does Oprah's favorite things. So if she's coming with Gail or if I'm going to see her or something, I make, you know, sometimes I'll get a book and a couple of ingredients I like and make a little basket or something. But it's the 2000th show, so I want to get one favorite thing. And the young lady who works on our show, Kara, she's the head of the wardrobe department. She's always looking for shoes that a person who's worked in kitchens since they were 12, my feet are very wide, much like Frodo. they're not made for girl shoes. So she's always looking for shoes that have a heel, because I'm very short and many of our guests are very tall, that are wide. So she found these amazing Yves Saint Laurent boots, and they had like a, they're black, but they have like gold leopard or ocelot or something. They have spots on them. They're kind of yellowish gold, right? And I love these shoes. They don't hurt. I ran around like a cuckoo all day in them, and we do three shows a day. I'm like, oh my God, Carrie, these are amazing. Your feet never hurt in them, but you could tape shows all day, all night. They're amazing. So when Oprah was coming for the 2000th show, I'm like, can you find out Oprah's shoe size? Kara, call Gail. Gail knows. Let's get Oprah's shoe size. I want to get her my favorite boots. That's the one favorite thing. And these boots are like more than the rent of my house, like the first house I rented.
Yep.
Right? Like, there's some shoes. They're Yves Saint Laurent, YSL. I'm like, oh my God, that's how much they cost. Like, I was so afraid once I found out how much they were. Anyway, I'm like, oh my God, so that's a really good thank you gift. That's a really good favorite thing. And they really are one of my favorite things because I love these boots. I'm going to give her these boots. So we get the boots and we do the bow in her favorite color. And I walk into the room and Oprah's gang's in there and they're like, okay, she's changing. We just had a big wardrobe malfunction. She was wearing a red dress and it had a hidden zipper. And it got stuck on the fabric, you know, all those stupid, you know, the ones that are hidden? Forget about it. So she lost the fight with the dress she wanted to wear for the show. So she put on the outfit that she came in, I guess, or whatever, you know. I'm just assuming it had to be the one she came in. She comes out, and it's a black V-neck shirt with a gold-yellow wraparound leather skirt that exactly matches the boots she's about to open. So she opens the boots and she literally jumps up and down like she's on the Oprah show when they want a car. And she's squealing and she's like, they match my outfit, they match my outfit. And she takes an Instagram and she's having everybody take pictures, she puts them on, they fit perfect. She came out and did the whole open of the show and danced around her boots, told everybody the story.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
That's funny. Yeah. Talk about full circle.
Right?
All those years later, and we're there for 2,000 episodes in our show, and she goes out there wearing my boots. Crazy.
And well worth the
now
money.
Now it's our boots.
So I adopted two kittens over the Christmas
Thank
holiday.
Thank you. I hope they're rescues.
And yes, they are rescues. They came from a rescue. My son absolutely loves them. But
What did you name them?
Champ and Chloe.
Adorable.
Yes, Champ
boy
and Chloe.
Boy and a girl.
Yes. We had to name them because my son wanted to name them Stripey and Stripey 2. They're white with no stripes.
And how long has he been seeing things?
Yeah, right? But I found myself in the pet store because it had been about 4 years since I had a pet, and I found myself in the pet store like looking at all the food, and I'm like, I don't remember what to do here. And like, I was actually reading the ingredients and then I'm like, okay, so wait a minute. Now there's healthy food for animals too. I didn't
but
know
we're
this.
The most affordable healthy food.
Nutrish, which by the way, I walked into PetSmart the other day, right as
I
soon
know.
As I walked in, I almost walked
we're
into
so
it.
Thrilled.
Yep, all right there in the front of the store.
So my daughter is not human. She is a red-nosed pit bull, and I only have red-nosed pit bulls because of people's ignorance about them. Pit bulls were actually introduced in the UK, and they're no longer allowed in the UK. They're literally outlawed there. which is weird because that's where they were created, and they were nanny dogs. They were literally bred to babysit your babies, your infant children. They were nursery dogs. They're very loving, sweet animals. Somewhere along the way, some messed up man or woman figured out that they had very strong jaws like crocodiles and that they would be good fighters. You know, nobody blames the guy who started cockfights, but somebody started pit bull fighting. And that's how they got the bad rap that they have. But that's why I only have red-nosed pit bulls as our family members. They're the most loving creatures. Bad rap is one of our huge donations from our food. And we started our food because Americans were unknowingly, of course, murdering their own furry family members, cats and dogs, because of how much pet food was being imported from other countries that wasn't being regulated. And because of the fillers and the horrible things they were stuffing in the food, people were poisoning animals. Now, I can't be home because of all of the jobs that I have. I can't be home every night, and I cook for my dogs largely because I know what pit bulls can eat and what they can't eat, and at what age they can eat those things because I've had them for so long. When I'm not home, John is not going to come home early to, like, make some barley and poach some chicken, you know? It's just not going to happen. So as a pet parent, I'm like, well, what do I buy? At the time, the company was called Dads. This lovely group of people reached out to me because a page in my magazine was dedicated to cooking for your dog or cat. They came to me and said, we would like to produce food in America that's based on your recipes, and we've brought you some samples. Adorable. So Isabu tried them. I read the ingredients. They were literally everything I could read, like a menu for humans. And all these years later, we have given away, we have raised and given away because of that food. And I eat all of the food. I've had the kibble. I've had the cat food on MSNBC twice. I've eaten every one of our products. You can eat them. They're delicious. They just need more salt for me. They're all delicious. You can read them like a menu. We have every diet. I swear, people that say their animals are sick or they lose their fur, or they're too old to eat this or they're too young to eat that, I swear to you, it's the best food you can buy. And we have given away $28 million because of that food.
Which is amazing. But I can't believe that you just said that you can eat the food, because I promise you, my six-year-old just told me, he goes, I want you to get some dog biscuits because we can actually eat them. I'm like, no, you can't, honey.
Yes,
he goes,
you can.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. So I'm going to go home and say, watch this show. It's called Rachel Ray. She said you're
I've
right.
I've eaten all of our kibble. It's a, you know, it makes people watch and pay attention to your brain. I've eaten all the kibble. I've eaten the cat food. I've eaten the wet dog food. It's delicious. It just truly needs a little salt. I mean, it's just dehydrated vegetables and meat. Like, you can read our labels sincerely like you can read a menu. I mean that sincerely. You can literally read them.
I know. I was in the pet store doing it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is. Yeah. Please keep doing it because you help a lot of animals.
Well, thank you for donating all of that money back to animal rescues.
Easy.
In 2006, you launched Yummo, which is a nonprofit organization that empowers kids and their families to develop healthy relationships with food and cooking.
Yummo was started because Oprah and President Clinton, they had both given me advice about, I feel very uncomfortable having too much money in the bank. You know, I just do. It's not my thing, and I thought I'd be a waitress or waiting on people all my life. And I wanted to figure out a path to pay it forward to the next generation. I work too much to have human kids, and I was trying to figure it out, what we were going to do as a group. So I got some advice from very smart people who are very good at giving stuff, and the Alliance for a Healthier Generation partnered with us, and Oprah's the one who told me the path that you give back should be about the thing that matters most to you. I make my living through food. So our first example was to give back through food. So when we created a brand, I drew two pots on a napkin, and I went to a company, and I said, could you make these two pots? From that, we now have a company that, I don't know, I think we've generated over $1 billion of sales or something close to it. We've always, from the beginning of that, given a percentage of it to our Yummo Foundation. Because we did one huge event, and we auctioned off a bunch of stuff, and we had all kinds of celebrities, and of course President Clinton was there, and big stars, and a music lineup, and all that. But it costs so much money to put those things on. I'm like, there has to be a better way. So another thing that I learned from both of them is just build a business model. clearly you know how to do business. That was what you were doing before you were on television. Just build a business model for this. So that's what we did. We built a business model to fund what we called Yummo, because they used to say Yummo on air because it's scripts. They didn't like you to say, oh my God, because some people took offense to you using the word God. So I started saying Yum, oh my God, had to stop saying my God, became Yum, oh, shut up. So children would say to me, Rachel Ray, Yummo, as if it was like one word. So that's why we called it Yummo. But basically, we try and spend a third of our money on lobbying for better school food and 12-month-a-year access to food for public school kids. A third of our money for scholarship programs, because we've gotten rid of VOTEC. We've gotten rid of everything. Home economics, basic skills for every public school child. You used to be able to graduate school and be able to get a job. You would know home ec, you would have gone to shop, you could fix a car, you could make yourself dinner. You could go out in life and, like, make money. You can't do that anymore. So we try to replace that with our educational programs. But we also have a scholarship program for any public school kid who wants to go forward into higher education in anything even vaguely related to food or hospitality. And then we spend a third of our money, unfortunately, on just hunger relief for American children, because we're a country that allows that. So over the years, the business model is you just keep selling stuff and making more stuff, and the money just keeps coming, so we have more and more to give away. Just last year, because of all of the natural disasters, our Yummo organization gave away $1 million just specifically to hurricane relief for kids that were hungry after storm. It's amazing.
It is, absolutely.
It's amazing. And all of these things run themselves. They are businesses. It's not like I sit home and, like, knit $28 million for animals or knit $1 million for hurricane, you know, fresh water and food. They literally are just all, everything we create, and it's a group of us, of people that believe the same thing. You don't have to be rich to have a rich life. Everybody should have a decent life. Everyone should have access to good, useful products and happy experiences and blah, blah, blah. All of the folks that work with us believe in that mantra and are willing to make a tiny bit of money for a lot of things rather than a lot of money on a few things, and are willing to share that money. It takes an enormous amount of people to be able to give away that amount of money, both the people that manufacture it and help you create it and the people that help you distribute it appropriately.
Just a few quick questions before we let you go.
Haven't you learned in the last half an hour there's no quick question?
I know. Well, and I sent this over.
Look at this stack of cards. She got through like two.
Yeah. As I like keep filtering through them. You answered a lot of the questions.
She's like, damn, she knows how to shut up. They don't give those talk shows away, girl.
No, I want to know what you do to relax or to have fun.
I don't relax very well. Anybody that loves me knows that about me. I don't like that word, actually. I find it kind of creepy. I love to paint. I love to take pictures. I like to draw. I love to cook. I love to play with my dog. I love to watch movies. I suck at sleeping, and I hate doing nothing. I can't stand spas. I am massage phobic. I absolutely hate what most people think of as the dream day off on an island and a beach and all that. I would literally rather have my teeth worked on. Because they always need to be, because I always blow off my sweet dentist, Dr. Guido. I have a pirate hole in my mouth where he wanted to put a jam another one back in there like months ago, and I've never gone back. I literally can't stand being idle. I can't stand it.
Well, you said you're almost 50. You're going to be 50 this year, and you don't look...
50, August 25th.
Oh, that's my birthday.
Birthday, buddy.
Birthday. And I'm going to be 40 this year.
All right. Well, I vaguely remember it. Cheers to that.
Well, listen, you don't look 50. That's what I was going to say. So for all the running around you do and how busy you are,
creams
you're doing
and
fine.
Potions, baby. Wear black.
I think I heard when you first arrived upstairs that you said you went to your favorite restaurant last night in Philly.
Zahav. Michael, or Mike Solomonov, is one of my favorite people on the planet. He's had a couple of knocks in life and leapt over them like Superman. He is amazing. His food is filled with love and thought and depth, and it is one of my favorite places on the planet, and maybe my favorite place in America to eat. I love it.
Wow, right here in Philly, great.
He also has Goldie Now, the falafel stand. And in New York at Chelsea Market, he has Dizengoff, fabulous Israeli snack bar with hummus and all different toppings. And sometimes he has za'atar fried chicken and a pita. And he has great Israeli wines and this crazy slushy thing that he adds liquor to that is just ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah, I love it. That was like a big, big deal last night to see him. And he gave me a friend of his, a new book, The Palestinian Table, I'm excited to read on the plane ride home.
Before we go, are we going to, do we want to ask a couple? No. Okay. So,
apparently I talk too much.
She talks too much. One last question. If you could give one bit of advice to the women in this room today, what would it be?
It would be the same as I give to every man in this room. Be kind to each other. Work harder than everybody else. Be grateful for your ability to work. Just be kind to each other and be grateful. I think that's the biggest lesson in life.
Rachel, thank you so much. It was an honor meeting you. Happy birthday in August.
Thank you, everybody.
Don't forget, you can catch The Rachel Ray Show weekdays, 10 a.m. on 6 ABC.
This has been Her Story with Kathy Romano. Her Story is produced by WBEN-FM in Philadelphia and airs weekly or on demand on your mobile device. Listen or subscribe at 957benfm.com.